Welcome to The Word from Porter Street, the podcast in which I, Chris Phillips, report on my teaching, research, and whatever else might occur to me to talk about. Well, welcome to the 13th installment here on January 10th, 2013. Last time I was talking about my time at the American Antiquarian Society, and I said this time I was going to talk more about my HIMSS project, especially what it means for me to be doing this project. What personal stake do I have in this? There are a couple of different ways I want to go into that, and they have to do with a couple of conversations that I've had with people over a range of years. The first one happened when I was still in graduate school. I was talking with my advisor. I was on the job market, and things seemed like they were starting to get somewhere, and one of the things that I needed to be ready to talk about in my job interviews was what I was going to do next once I was done with a project on EPIC, what was going to follow that. And one of the things that I tossed out was I'm interested in doing a project on hymns and how people were reading hymns. And my advisor said, well, that topic sounds a little thin. And what he meant by that was he didn't think there was enough in it for me to produce a book, especially produce a book that was up to his standards, certainly what was up to his expectations compared to the EPIC project, which he'd been very happy with, very supportive of. And he added on a really, what I found a kind of disturbing comment, but one that I've given a lot of thought to since. He said, you don't want to be labeled as a Christian scholar. And over time, that was probably about 6 years ago that we had that conversation. And since that time, my advisor has passed away. I have moved on to my first job, have finished the book after finishing the dissertation, and I'm now working on this HIMSS project. And I think about what does it mean for me to be a Christian scholar? What does that have to do with this particular work that I'm doing? It certainly has value for history of the book scholarship. It has value for the history of poetry. But what else is going on there? What does it mean for this project to potentially mark me as a Christian scholar? The second conversation followed this point, and it was not nearly as agonistic as that first conversation had been, but there was definitely still a fairly sharp point to it. And the question that was put to me was, what would be the value of this project beyond evangelical circles? As I just mentioned, there are these larger values, and this was part of what I was trying to articulate at that stage. I was just getting into the research for this project, a very, very early stage, about 2.5 years ago, and I was at the point where I was still trying to write, say, in a page, what it was that I wanted to do. And this question was a very helpful question to have at that stage, but it's also one that has stuck with me and that I've reflected on. Because one of the things about a project on hymns is that it does have appeal for people in evangelical circles, especially people of specific kinds of evangelical traditions, and particularly people who are evangelicals of a certain age, if I may say so. This is something that is a part of an American religious heritage, a very specific one. And even as various other religious heritages have absorbed the process of singing hymns, the practice of singing hymns, this is very much owned by a certain demographic, and especially within the academy, I think it's seen as belonging to a certain demographic more than others. And that actually potentially causes problems. And so I think this is part of what that Christian scholar comment that my advisor made might have been getting at. It's not that this project doesn't have academic value. I think it very clearly does. And as I've described it to people over the last couple of years, I've gotten feedback showing that other people agree with me. There is considerable academic value to this. But the fact that it has extra academic value in religious circles can potentially make it suspect. It doesn't matter, in one sense, whether it has academic value. I also have to be ready to guard against the fact that it might have too much value somewhere outside the academy. I find this just a fascinating and ironic turn of events after working on a project dealing with the most elite forms of poetry in Western literature, epic, to now be working on a project where I'm dealing with things that I very much experience as poetry. I'm looking at authors that anybody would consider poets. Even Walt Whitman said in his preface to Leaves of Grass in 1855 that what he was doing, he wasn't trying to write an epic, he said he was trying to write a psalm. So there is something about the hymn as poetry, and the relationship between hymn and psalm is something I don't want to get into here, but there's a relationship between these hymn, psalm, poem concepts, but the way these play out have much to do with church, what people think church is, and what that says about people who study and are interested in these kinds of things. So now I have some interesting challenges to work through with this, because the fact is I do have extra academic interest in hymns. I grew up as a pastor's kid in a hymn-singing church. I am still a member of, in fact, not one, but two hymn-singing churches. And this is something that has been very important to me for a very long time. At a visceral level, the experience of singing hymns within a group of fellow believers is an incredible experience. It's one of the most valuable things for me in the worship experience in any church, and something that I find translates more easily from one church to another than almost any other aspect of the liturgy. So there's that side of things that attracted me to this. I first started getting interested in this topic as something that I would study in an academic way when I was TAing in grad school, in fact, for my advisor. I was teaching Jonathan Edwards and trying to figure out how to get students to understand some of the imagery that Edwards uses. And I wanted to tap into some of the eroticism that shows up in Puritan literature. A lot of people think of Puritans as very straight-laced, but many of them had deeply emotional ways of expressing their faith, and a lot of times they would use imagery from Song of Solomon, probably the most vivid and erotic poem in the Bible. And that kind of rhetoric is not necessarily obvious to somebody who's reading a Jonathan Edwards sermon for the first time, that in fact this is charged with this kind of imagery of how wonderful God is and how sensuous the experience of the goodness of God can be. And so I went looking for hymns to bring in, specifically Christ the Apple Tree, which is filled with some of this wonderful, luscious, sensuous imagery. And that was a folk hymn that was first published in the 1780s in New England, and has since become, in fact, a popular Christmas hymn in England. So it hopped the Atlantic, then came back, and people now think of it as a Christmas hymn, but in fact started as just a celebration of the believer's relationship with Christ. And as I was looking at the books that this first appeared in, I started to become really intrigued that the title pages would often say something like, "For use of religious assemblies and private Christians." And I thought, how odd that a book would be designed for both public and private use, especially when it was in pocket size. And this was something that I wanted to follow up on. And so that was the initial question that started off this study. But yet there's all this personal life that stands behind that. So one of the things that I have to decide with this project, not necessarily in the way that I write it, but I think in the way that I go about it, the way that I think of it, maybe the way that I talk about it with people, and it may also, in fact, wind up impacting the writing, is how much of my faith goes into a work like this. I certainly have a fair amount of background knowledge about the Bible, about hymn singing, that kind of thing, that I can bring into this study by virtue of my upbringing. But what about the emotional payoff? And I've been trying to think of analogs to this. I wonder how similar it is, for instance, to some of the works of feminist criticism, of African-American criticism, especially thinking of someone like Henry Louis Gates writing his early works, trying to figure out how can you bring the Black experience into a literary conversation that has been excluding blacks for a very long time, but you can use the tools of that conversation and the jargon of it in order to explain the black experience to a population that's been ignoring that. Is there some way that this works as an identity, going back to that idea of being a Christian scholar? I've always been a scholar who is a Christian, and that's something that I've usually taken for granted. But what about the idea of being a Christian scholar, of being someone whose faith actually lies behind what it is that I'm working on? And perhaps that lies behind working on epic just as much as it does with hymns. But as in the case of Henry Louis Gates, when I have content that reflects my experience, reflects my identity, Henry Louis Gates has been one of the first people to say, you do not need to be black to write about African-American authors. I don't think that you need to be Christian to write about hymns. In fact, at the American Antiquarian Society, one of the other researchers confessed to me, everything he knows about Isaac Watts, he knows from my advisor's publications. And my advisor was not a religious man by any stretch of the imagination. In fact, he half-joked to my wife when I started the PhD program that he was going to make an atheist of me in 5 years. This is not the kind of person that you think is going to really be able to explain the truth of Isaac Watts, and yet he had a talent for being able to explain what really was at stake for early Americans reading Isaac Watts's poetry. So I'm trying to figure out what that identity means. How does it fit into larger ideas and conversations about identity, and how is this going to affect my process, affect the way that I think about what it is that I'm producing in this study of hymns? I very much would invite feedback in written form, comments to this podcast, personal conversations. This is something that I'm going to be sitting with for, I think, a very long time, much longer than this project will take. And this is, in some ways, my first foray into taking this public in some way or other, and trying to work this out within a larger community. So thank you for those of you who are going to give feedback for this. And thank you for the rest of you just to listen as I'm thinking out loud through all of this. Next time I will be back in more regular business talking about more concrete things that are going on. But this is a question that I've been really trying to work through lately. And the poem that I want to end this podcast with is one that I think very nicely bridges for me the personal, spiritual side of encountering hymns and the academic side. This is a hymn for Epiphany, the Feast of Epiphany, which was celebrated in the church calendar just a few days ago on January 6th. This is the 12th day of Christmas, 12th night, the day of the three kings. It's known by several different names. This is a hymn by Reginald Heber, who was a very popular poet in Oxford circles, who climbed the ladder in the Church of England very quickly, became Bishop of Calcutta, and died at a fairly early age. He was still in his 30s when he died, and he left behind a set of poems that were meant to be what he hoped would become a hymn book for the Church of England. They were hymns built around the liturgical year rather than following scriptural themes or following the Psalms as earlier collections such as Watts's had done. And this was one of the first hymns that he ever brought into print in the magazine The Christian Observer out of London in 1811. It was very quickly reprinted in America as well as all over the United Kingdom, and in fact made it into the Southern Harmony and the Sacred Harp, and is still sung in altered form in both of those books and shapenote communities today. One of the things that I'm interested in this project is looking at Heber as someone who manages to bridge the experience of hymns with the experience of poetry. These two things were thought to be distinct in the 18th century, and Heber at the beginning of the 19th century really tries to bring those two together In fact, the American critic Rufus Griswold in the mid-19th century said of Heber that he was one of the sweetest of the poets who have sung of religion. He said, "His hymns are for the Christian what the unchaste songs of Thomas More are for the sensualist." This is really intense stuff. And this Epiphany hymn, which, as I mentioned, was set to music, it was sung in many hymnals, and the fact that it goes into the Southern Harmony and the Sacred Harp, these are vernacular, largely Baptist American traditions. So for a high church Anglican to wind up in that circle, there's some considerable reach and some serious crossover power to this man's writings. "Brightest and best of the sons of the morning, dawn on our darkness, and lend us thine aid. Star of the east, the horizon adorning, guide where our infant Redeemer is laid. Cold on his cradle the dewdrops are shining, low lies his bed with the beasts of the stall. Angels adore him in slumber reclining, Maker and Monarch and Savior of all. Say, shall we yield him in costly devotion, odors of Edom and offerings divine, gems of the mountain and pearls of the ocean, myrrh from the forest and gold from the mine? Vainly we offer each ample oblation, vainly with gold would his favor secure. Richer by far is the heart's adoration, dearer to God are the prayers of the poor. Brightest and best of the sons of the morning, dawn on our darkness and lend us thine aid. Star of the east, the horizon adorning, guide where our infant Redeemer is laid." That concludes this installment, and until next time, may you find good words and delight in the words that find you.